Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Today's episode is part of the special Election 2020 series on the President's Inbox. Each week between now and the Iowa caucuses, I'm sitting down with two experts with different views on how the United States should deal with the foreign policy challenges it faces. We hope that these contending views will give you a fuller understanding of what the candidates are and aren't saying on the campaign trail. This week's topic is whether free trade agreements serve U.S. interests. With me to discuss U.S. trade policy are Jennifer Hillman and Thea Lee. Jennifer is the Senior Fellow for Trade and International Political Economy here at CFR and a professor of practice at the Georgetown University Law Center. She served as a member of the World Trade Organization's highest court, the appellate body. She has also served as general counsel at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, among other U.S. government positions. Jennifer, thank you for joining me.
Delighted and honored to be here.
Thea is the president of the Economic Policy Institute, a Washington-based think tank that focuses on the economic condition of low and middle-income Americans and their families. She was previously the deputy chief of staff at the AFL-CIO, where she also held positions as policy director and chief international economist. She currently serves on the congressionally mandated U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. Thea, thank you for joining us today.
Jim, thank you for having me.
This is obviously a big question. It's also a pretty complicated question. So what I'd like to do is sort of start by sort of mapping out what the basic issues and challenges are. So if I could start with you, Jennifer, could you just sort of lay out for us a description of what U.S. trade policy is? And do we, in fact, really have free trade agreements?
Well, U.S. trade policy has generally been to try to open up markets around the world for U.S. goods, for U.S. services, and for U.S. products that contain intellectual property. So those are typically the three basic elements that are covered in trade agreements. And we say open up markets, what you're really trying to do is to convince other countries to lower the tariffs that they have that affect goods, to change the way in which they do or do not open up their market to services and the trade in everything from financial services to architectural services, etc. And then lastly, to have significant policies in place that would protect intellectual property. So this would be patents or copyrights or trademarks or trade secrets. So again, do they have laws that would protect those kind of rights that might come out of the United States? So that's typically what a trade agreement looks to do, to open up that market so that U.S. goods, including agriculture and others, can move across out of the United States and into those other markets.
Can I just get a quick clarification? You mentioned services, and I think for a lot of people, it's not clear what services are. You mentioned financial services. Could you give us just some meat in the bones as to what we mean when we talk about services?
So generally, services are just considered those things that are not tangible, meaning you can't touch them. So they're not a physical good. They're not like trading in an automobile or a piece of steel or a piece of aluminum. They're trading in the service that often goes behind it. So commonly traded services would be things like financial services. So if we want to do banking overseas, we can take deposits or, again, have ATM branches or even branches of our banks overseas. They're obviously not trading in just the physical good of a piece of money. They're trading in the broader financial service. But it can be an entire array of financial services. So again, it can cross a large gamut of services. Services are often hard to understand in the trade way because they don't trade in the same way that a good does.
Because a good physically moves
from
one place to another.
So when a good trades, it literally goes from one country and crosses an international border to go into another country.
So your Iowa soybean ends up on the plate in Beijing.
Exactly. Whereas services trade in a lot of different ways. I mean, some of it can be as easy as the service of a, say, a computer program that gets downloaded in another country. So the service has traded by moving the service itself across the border. But services can also be traded in a lot of other ways. If, for example, an executive of a company moves across the border to provide the service of managing that company, that is a different way in which services can be traded. So there's generally considered four different ways in which services trade. So in that sense, they are a little bit more complicated than goods when you think about it.
One other clarification, that is, our trade agreements are often described as free trade agreements. What precisely does that mean, and are they really free trade?
No, they're not really free trade. What free trade means, though, is you are trying to get to the point where the barriers to trade, particularly the tariffs on goods.
And those are taxes on imports.
Those are taxes on imports. So a tariff is a tax on an import. The idea behind the free trade agreement is that you're trying to get at least substantially all of the goods that would be traded subject to no tariffs, zero duty rates.
But tariffs aren't the only impediment to trade in goods or services.
Correct. Many of the most important of the barriers to trade in goods or services are regulatory barriers or other kinds of what are referred to as non-tariff barriers.
NTBs.
Correct.
Okay. Thea, I want to bring you in here. You have worked this issue for a very long time, and you have been, I think it's fair to say, a critic of U.S. trade policy. Could I get you to lay out where you see U.S. trade policy falling down?
Sure. Thanks for the question. So as Jennifer said, trade policy is a set of agreements between countries about the terms of competition. And because countries have different regulatory systems, they have different labor market institutions, they have different ways of regulating industry, when they trade goods or services across borders, often there is inconsistency or an incompatibility. And one of the things that we have to agree when we do a trade agreement is which of these inconsistencies are we going to try to address to have a level playing field or to have fairness across borders. And our argument would be, I would call it the global justice critique of U.S. trade deals has been that U.S. trade policy since the NAFTA deal, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Early 1990s
has been focused much more on corporate interests, corporate profits, corporate mobility and flexibility and freedom from regulation than it has been on other kind of more important bread and butter issues to communities, whether it is worker rights or environmental protections or even consumer safety. So there's a whole, maybe almost an infinite number of things that we could negotiate when we negotiate a trade agreement. And the criticism of U.S. trade policy has been that the focus and the balance of the priorities of the U.S. negotiators has been too much on corporate interest. And part of what the outcome has been to reward and accelerate and exacerbate outsourcing rather than exports. You know, we talk about trade agreements that you're going to open up markets and reduce tariff barriers, but a lot of what U.S. negotiators have focused on has also been about how foreign investors are treated in a country, you know, whether there's investor-state dispute settlement and, as Jennifer said, the treatment of intellectual property or even the treatment of financial services. So those kinds of things, not to say they aren't all important, but that there's been an imbalance of things as opposed to, for example, focusing on things that might be important to workers. So if, let's say, workers at an auto plant in Michigan are facing a free trade agreement with Mexico, the question might be fair. Are the workers in Mexico afforded the same kind of rights and protections that American workers are afforded? Can they exercise internationally recognized rights of freedom of association, the right to bargain collectively? Is child labor protected? Is forced labor protected? So I think that's a very legitimate set of questions. It's an important set of questions. It goes more to the quality of jobs, to wages. It goes to inequality. And that's why I think there's been so much criticism of U.S. trade policy over the last few decades.
Okay, so as I look at it, I want to make sure I understand. The criticism isn't about trade per se, but it's about what rules should govern trade with other countries. And that's where the debate is rooted.
Exactly. And that's why, in some ways, the trade debate has been miscast as one between free trade and protectionism, as though there's one thing called free trade, which is clean and easy to describe, and one thing called protectionism, which is a lack of trade. And I think almost all the arguments certainly on the labor and environment side have been, we need a better balance of rules for trade deals, not that we need to stop trading.
So we're talking about the devil's in the details, and we're going to sort of plunge in to the details in a minute. But I want to get a sense from you, because obviously the Economic Policy Institute works on issues besides trade, and it is really sort of focused on, I guess, the big question of making globalization work for American workers. And that is, when you look at trade policy, you're critical, but how does trade policy rank on the issues that you see as undercutting American workers? I think it's safe to say we have growing income inequality in this country, pretty evident wage stagnation, but trade presumably isn't the only factor, and again, you've testified on a number of issues. I just want to get a sense of where trade policy fits in sort of the causal factors you see undermining the American worker.
Thanks, Jim. That is a great question and a complicated one, of course. So I would say that trade is an important factor, not the only factor, may not even be the largest factor. factor that is contributing to lower wages and wage stagnation and inequality. But it is, in some ways, some of the other issues that we would see, like the attacks on unions or the macroeconomic policy that has put too much focus on getting inflation down but not enough focus on full employment, and the erosion of the minimum wage and other labor standards and labor protection.
Underinvestment in infrastructure, education, skills training, and the like.
All those things, and technology to some extent also. All those things together, I would say, in some ways have some of the same goal, which is to undermine the bargaining power of working people. And that's why trade policy is, it's hard to separate the impact and to put a fine line even between trade and technology. Because, for example, if a company is interested in outsourcing and technology is changing very rapidly, it may be that as more jobs go overseas or as cheap imports come in, there's more pressure to adopt new technologies. And so there may be interacting factors between trade and technological change, for example. But at the end of the day, you've almost had a doubling down. Like sometimes trade economists like to talk about, we could have freer trade and some people will benefit and some people will be hurt. Maybe the people who will be hurt will be, let's say, less skilled workers, those without a college degree. In the United States, that's maybe 2/3 of the labor force, pretty significant chunk of people. And then economists always say, but you could, it would be possible to tax the winners and compensate the losers and have everybody come out ahead. And the problem in U.S. politics is that not only did we not do that, we didn't tax the winners and compensate the losers. It's almost like we used the tax code and we eroded the social safety net to tax the losers and compensate the winners. And so you had an exacerbation of inequality in many, many different dimensions over the last couple of decades.
Okay, so this for you is an issue embedded in a much bigger critique of the American economy.
Exactly.
Okay. I want to sort of draw on your experience here, Jennifer, because you worked at the U.S. Trade Representative. You also, as I mentioned at the outset, was on the appellate body of the World Trade Organization. But you were also U.S. Ambassador, I think it was at the textile negotiations. Can you sort of help me think about how U.S. negotiators think about what they're doing when they go to these negotiations? Because, you know, obviously, Thea has just laid out a critique that the big picture going into these negotiations leaves a lot out. So I want to get your sense of how it looks from where you sat.
Yeah, because I don't disagree with some of what Thea has said. And clearly what we've seen sort of over time is that, yes, the point of a lot of these negotiations is to open up a new market. And what you clearly do see is when you open up that door, who walks through it? Okay. And what we are increasingly seeing is who walks through the door is those with capital and those with know-how. And that does tend to push back then on the exact kinds of things that Thea is describing. As a negotiator, what you're really trying to look for is, okay, if I open up this door, do I have American companies and presumably workers from the United States that are producing a product that can take advantage of that new market? So, for example, when I was doing textile negotiations where we were trying to get new market access into markets that had never been open to us before, you really wanted to make sure you were focusing on the items where the U.S. did have a readily available competitive industry that could produce those exact products so that when you open that door, they were right there and ready to move with you. The other thing that I was doing on the textile side was at the time we had quotas on imports. And so part of that job was trying to think about how do you distribute those quotas in a way that would be helpful, not just in terms of protecting the U.S. market in the most sensitive sectors where there was the most vulnerability, but also trying to figure out across the board with your various trading partners involved, where are you allocating quota that makes the most sense from a development standpoint or others? I mean, how do you make sure that there is room for Haiti or for Jamaica or for a number of other, whether it's Bangladesh or others, to get into our market? And part of that was by keeping the levels that you were going to permit from China or other really large countries at the lowest level that you could in order to make room in the U.S. market for a much broader array of imports.
But I would imagine you're in a bit of a difficult spot because you're trying to negotiate a deal. And that means you have to get concessions from the other side, but you also have to give concessions. But at the end of the day, you also, it isn't simply enough to get agreement from your negotiating partner. You have to bring it back to Capitol Hill and get members of Congress to sign off on these deals because Congress has the power over foreign commerce. And my sense is that that can be a very difficult needle to thread, given that a deal that will alarm one part of Congress will make another part of Congress really happy. So how do you think about the politics of that?
Well, and I would say the politics are really different depending on whether you're negotiating a bilateral bilateral agreement or a multilateral agreement.
Okay, so bilateral is just one other partner, multilateral.
Bilateral agreement is just one other country. And what you find, and I think if you look over time, with bilateral agreements, there's less to trade off. Again, I think it gets harder in terms of building a constituency for it. And then on the other end of it, it also becomes very clear that a lot of the debate on Capitol Hill about whether you want to agree to that agreement really does depend on how members of Congress feel about or think of that particular country. So it becomes very much a sort of, do we like Colombia or not? Where are we in terms of how do we think about Peru or not? As opposed to a multilateral agreement. When you do a big multilateral agreement, like the Uruguay round that led to the development of the WTO, the thinking is much more on the, well, I like the agreement on agriculture, I don't so much like this other provision. I may like the provisions on textiles and clothing, but I don't like the provisions on something else. And it tends to be much more focused on these trade-offs that were made among sectors, again, within the U.S. economy, more than a focus on whether I like a particular country or not. So very different dynamics there. But your basic question pushes to the view of the agreements have to be big enough and significant enough to have a lot of these trade-offs in order to get the support to get them passed through the Congress.
Thea, you wanted to jump in here?
Sure. And I think Jennifer's raised a number of interesting issues. And one of them is that, you know, our trade policy sometimes also is development policy or foreign policy, you know, trying to balance the interests of different nations or trying to decide which nations are more worthy or more deserving of a trade agreement. And what are the criteria that we apply? Should the country be a democracy? Should they respect basic human rights? Should they have LGBT rights and rights for women?
Environmental protections,
and how do they treat their workers? And what are the wages low because it's a poor country? Are the wages low because the government goes out and busts union and throws people in jail and maybe looks the other way when union leaders are assassinated? Those are pretty important questions, and it's one of the things that we've been battling about for the last couple of decades in the United States around trade deals is, you know, how do these countries get chosen? And really part of the issue, and I know Jennifer is a very seasoned trade negotiator, and I have a lot of respect for our trade negotiators.
And I should point out, you've been to a lot of trade negotiations as an observer, so.
I have. I'm, you know, representing the AFL-CIO as on the Labor Advisory Committee and other places, be part of like a big multinational labor delegation, often at the World Trade Organization in particular, but also for the bilateral and the regional trade deals. So our negotiators are balancing a lot of different concerns. They're balancing whether they can get this through the U.S. Congress or not. And sometimes these things happen in too much secrecy, and that's been one of the criticisms over the years, that I think the civil society groups want to open things up more. They want more access so that they can see if there's a problem, precisely for the reason that Jennifer said, which is that by the time the deal comes to Congress, it's an up or down vote almost always. It's a fast-track vote where Congress can't say, I like Section 1, but not Section 2.
Well, but there's a reason for that, because back in the old days when you could amend it, everyone would say, I love the deal except for.
Exactly.
And then it would all come unraveled.
But that's, I think, a good reason, an argument for having more transparency as the deal is negotiated, because if there's going to be a problem, and sometimes negotiators are not, you know, they're not all seeing, they're not omniscient, they can't read everybody's mind. But if you raise something and say, oh my gosh, I had no idea this was going to be a super hot concern for a lot of people. But I think one other thing I would just say in terms of trade deals, they're about opening up markets and who walks through the door. But it's also true that for the United States, our consumer market is extremely attractive to pretty much every other country in the world. So when we enter into a trade negotiation, a bilateral or a regional negotiation with another country, we have a lot of clout. And our government has tended to use that clout to extract concessions that are good for multinational corporations and maybe better for outsourcing than they are for exporting in many cases, not all, but in many cases. And I think that's been one of the cruxes of
why. Can I draw you out on that, though? Because obviously corporations employ people. And so if you're an American who works for one of these corporations, this is important to your livelihood. So, I mean, how do you think about this issue? Because obviously, this is something in which decisions have consequences. Some people do win, some people don't win.
Well, one question is the corporation going to serve that market by producing more stuff in the United States with American workers and pay them good wages? Or are they going to serve that foreign market by moving production, let's say, of an aircraft to another country, producing it there, hiring people there, and the people who are left behind, the community that's left behind, is devastated in many cases, and the tax base is devastated. So it isn't even just the people who worked at that factory, it might be the teachers and the firefighters and the police that also feel that
impact. This is a multiplier effect.
And so, you know, it is complicated to try to unpack what a corporation's interest is from what the community's interest. And I guess one of the lessons I have from, you know, many decades of being involved in these trade deals is that you cannot assume that the corporation is going to make a decision that's in the best interest of its workers and its communities. They might, but they don't always.
I want to ask you just this one last question about process, Jennifer, and that's the issue that you raised about transparency. I can see the argument for transparency, certainly on the basis of democratic principles, but I can also imagine that if you're trying to negotiate something, transparency can make your life miserable. And so the question is, how do you sort of view this issue of transparency?
Well, I think you need a lot of transparency at various points in the negotiation. I'm not sure you need it at every point. I think Thea is absolutely right. There ought to be a lot of transparency when you go to choose the partner that you're going to enter into a negotiation with. There ought to be complete and absolute transparency to look at, do we want to do an agreement with whatever the other country may be? I also think there ought to be an awful lot of transparency around the issues of what are going to be the chapters of the agreement. What subjects are you covering? Are there certain subjects that we should not be covering? Are there additional subjects that ought to be included? There's no question that I think that would go a long way. When you get down to the actual text of the negotiations, I think there needs to be actually some period of time in which there isn't full transparency, because it simply is not very possible to have every single person knowing exactly every offer and every counteroffer in terms of actually trying to get there. But once you've got the parameters set with a great deal of transparency, let the negotiators do their work. But then I agree with Thea on the back end. There needs to be a lot of transparency once you've gotten the agreement before it gets translated into actual legislation that would go to the Congress. So I'm not disagreeing that there needs to be more transparency, I think, than we
have
right now.
You just want it in the right places.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the issues with transparency is that we have a system for these advisory committees, the trade advisory committees, that are severely imbalanced towards corporations. There are, I think, 17 of the industry sector advisory committees and only one labor and now one environment committee. And one of the things that we've been fighting about over the years is, shouldn't there be labor, environment, and consumer representatives on each of the corporate or the industry sector advisory committees?
Let me just ask you just a quick question, Thea. Yeah. Who set up those advisors? Those are part of law.
Those are part of law. They're established, and the executive branch, I think, generally makes the appointments to them. I've been on the labor advisory committee for many years. I'm not right now because I'm not working for the labor movement anymore. But there's that one little, the labor advisory committee, but we want it to be on the auto advisory committee, on the services advisory committee, on the chemicals and the paper. And because there are decisions that are being made by only corporate representatives. And that, I think, is the wrong kind of transparency. The exact point at which you make everything available, I think, is a good question. The real thing that needs to be kept secret in a negotiation is your bottom line. That's what you don't want the other side to know. Like, I would go down to 0.2%. And that's never been made available. So I've had more access to transparency and to documents, to the negotiating documents as part of the Labor Advisory Committee. And most of it's not that scary. Most of it, like 98% of what is shown to the advisory committees, is the same text from the last trade agreement, because that's how negotiators tend to work, is that they start with the last one and they work forward. But part of the problem for me was, even if I saw something that was troubling there, I could not tell my boss, I could not tell my members, I could not tell a journalist. And that I found very constricting.
What I'd like to do is sort of move off this process question and actually talk about actual trade agreements. And maybe we can begin with the World Trade Organization, since it's sort of the umbrella organization for the international trading system. My sense is you have very different views on the World Trade Organization. Jennifer, you sat on the appellate body. I know you have criticisms of the WTO, but you're also worried that it may be soon paralyzed and unable to operate. Let me sort of flesh out your case for the WTO.
Well, for me, the key thing that the WTO does is establish some really important baseline rules. And the most important to me are the rules that say that you cannot discriminate on the basis of nationality, the so-called most favored nation principle. And to me, that's absolutely critical for U.S. companies and U.S. goods and services that trade around the world, that you cannot be just discriminated against simply because it's American. And therefore, I'm going to put a different tariff, or therefore, I'm going to ban it, or therefore, I'm going to do something with it solely on the basis of that nationality. And the other, to me, bedrock principle of the WTO that's very important is the concept of national treatment, meaning you cannot discriminate against a foreign item simply because it's foreign. Those are, I think, really important rules that help establish some stability and predictability in the trading system. The rest of the rules, again, are going to go into the details of every sector. What I think is important to understand hand is that the WTO works by schedules. In other words, you can put tariffs on at whatever level you put into your schedule. No one makes you put in a particular tariff level. That's the subject of your own sovereign decision and as a result of the negotiations that you've had with everybody else. Similarly for services. Yes, there is a general agreement on trade and services in the WTO, but does it make you open up your market to services? No. You allow as much trade in services as you put into your own
services. So it's a framework under which you can operate.
Exactly. It is a framework under which you operate that has every country having a lot of rights in its own sovereign space to determine what it wants to do, but subject to these bedrock principles that you cannot discriminate on the basis of nationality and you cannot discriminate against foreign just because it's foreign. With those basic principles undergirding it, the rest of it is a lot of very specific sort of sovereign decisions. And then again, some very specific decisions around transparency. If you're going to impose a measure that says I'm not going to permit in imports of apples because I don't want a particular disease that is in apples, you have to tell the world that that's what you're going to do. So the framework is one that still allows a lot of sovereign rights to be exercised within it, and yet it has rules that give predictability and certainty to everybody. And then to me, most importantly, the WTO then becomes a forum for discussion of what exactly are everyone's rules and a forum to resolve disputes over disagreements about whether or not you have effectively taken away rights that I believed or a country believes that it has under the rules.
I know you're a critic, so what is your criticism of the WTO? And is it that you want it reformed or do you want it replaced?
Reformed. And actually, you know, believe it or not, I don't disagree with a lot of what Jennifer said in terms of the usefulness of having a format for multilateral rules. And in fact, if I were queen of the world, I would want more emphasis to be put on the multilateral rulemaking and less on the bilateral and regional, which I think does create what we sometimes call the spaghetti bowl of different rules and provisions and so on, that it would be more efficient if we could agree. Part of my criticism of the WTO has to do with what our own government, what the United States government has and hasn't done in terms of setting priorities for what is it that we need to do together in a coordinated way across national borders that we cannot do as individual countries. And I think there are a lot of issues that should be on the table at the WTO that have not been. Obviously, core labor rights, which is something I've mentioned before, but also currency manipulation or currency misalignment. Even though the WTO in principle has rules to address that, they've been paralyzed and unable and unwilling to settle some of those disputes. I think another issue would be climate change, where countries acting by themselves without coordination are not going to be able to solve the global climate problem. They need to coordinate, and that needs to be made clear through WTO rules, and I know Jennifer has looked at this, that if countries want to move more quickly, let's say one country wanted to move more quickly to reduce carbon emissions, that country shouldn't be penalized by having all the industry move out to a dirtier place, because that actually, it's inefficient and it will increase global emissions if we don't allow some border adjustment mechanisms to take place. But with respect to labor standards, this is a clear lack at the WTO. The WTO talks about subsidies. They talk about tariffs. They talk about, as Jennifer said, the principles of national treatment and non-discrimination. And yet, let's say, for example, one country, you have very stringent rules that ban child labor, and another country has no rules on child labor. So small children are chained to a loom and enforced labor, slave labor, forced to produce cheap garments. Should the first country be forced to import goods made by child slave labor? The WTO does not speak to that. It has no rules on that. There's a rule on prison labor, but not a rule on forced labor, and not a rule on child labor, and not a rule on some of the other very basic internationally agreed rules on core labor rights that the International Labor Organization
has. Jennifer, why doesn't the WTO tackle these issues?
Well, I think it's mostly historical, and then nowadays I think it's just very hard to get new agreements on anything brought into the WTO. So again, I think part of that is it came out of this general agreement on tariffs and trade, which basically focused solely on goods and solely on tariffs. And then in the 1990s, there was a negotiation, this Uruguay round negotiations, that led to the creation of the WTO. And at that time, I think it was still considered actually quite controversial to include labor or the environment directly within trade agreements. I think we've moved a long way from there. Obviously, we are seeing in trade agreements around around the world the inclusion now of labor and environment provisions. But at the time that this was negotiated, I think that was not considered an appropriate part of a trade agreement, probably by mistake. And the second thing in terms of labor was a perception that there is the existing International Labor Organization, and the presumption is the WTO would do trade and the ILO would do labor. And I think, as Thea is pointing out very clearly, that has not worked, and that the only way that you're going to get more effective, real effective disciplines on labor rights is to bring them into the WTO. And the reason for that comes to the fact that it is the WTO that has a binding dispute settlement mechanism, and that has the ability to actually, through the form of trade sanctions or tariffs, to actually put some teeth into whatever the rules are. So I think that both the politics of it and the understanding about it has changed over time. And yet right now, the WTO is at a place in which it's been hard to reach any agreements on any new subject since 1995. And therefore, I think even though there may be much more of a sentiment that it would be appropriate to bring in these labor disciplines, you cannot get those kind of agreements right now.
I want to move away from the WTO and talk about...
I wanted to say one thing before we do move away from the WTO, which is, historically, interestingly enough, the precursor to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the ITO, the International Trade Organization, actually did include labor rights. So that was, you know, a missed opportunity that happened many, many years ago that could have been...
Long before all of us were born, I should point out.
Long before we were born, that there was some movement and I think some justification and some understanding that labor rights is, or labor standards is, a form of international competition, that there would be an advantage to having some floor, some minimum standards that were agreed across national borders.
Let's talk about NAFTA, which has been a big issue in the trade space for a long time, going back to the early 1990s. And I will note that I've had the pleasure of living in a variety of parts of the country. Having lived in Michigan and traveling there frequently, I know NAFTA is very unpopular in much of the Rust Belt. But I've also lived in Texas, where there are a lot of fans of NAFTA. This gets back to the question of winners and losers from trade deals. Thea, can you sort of lay out for us sort of your critique of NAFTA, why it was not a good idea?
Sure. So the North American Free Trade Agreement was negotiated between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada in the early 1990s, originally by the George Herbert Walker Bush administration and then finished by the Clinton administration. And this was, I think, the first trade agreement with a developing country, because the U.S. had an FTA with Canada and with Israel at that time. But Mexico, this was a new thing. And the question was, what was the goal of NAFTA? And some of the negotiators at the time, I did a lot of debates about NAFTA at the time. I was a trade economist at EPI, talked about this was about basically disciplining Mexico and trying to make sure that for American companies that wanted to move production to Mexico, that they had what they would call fair treatment, that their intellectual property rights were protected, and that if Mexican courts treated them unfairly, that they would have recourse, supranational recourse, to this investor state dispute settlement mechanism. So it was conceived to take tariff barriers down, but it really was always an outsourcing agreement more than it was an export agreement. So the public debate about NAFTA was all about, oh, don't you want to sell goods to Mexico on our southern border? And of course, everybody wants to sell goods. Exports are good. Exports are good for labor. They're good for business. But the subtext was about moving production and not selling goods. And if you look at the 1,000 pages of NAFTA, it was negotiated for outsourcers, not for exporters.
So do you think
the labor and environment provisions that were added by the Clinton administration at the very end were very weak, and they were not enforceable, and they didn't cover the key issues. And so it was always a lopsided agreement that didn't do enough, that was designed to accelerate outsourcing, and it did.
So do you think that the revised NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA, does that address that concern? Because I know one of the negotiating points for the Trump administration was getting content rules increased so that more of the sort of inputs had to be manufactured in the United States.
The new NAFTA, the USMCA, certainly addresses some of the concerns that were raised at the time, some of the concerns that have made NAFTA so unpopular over the last couple of decades. I think there's still an open question about whether some, especially the labor provisions and the rule of origin provisions, are enforceable and will be implemented fully. And so I think that's what the core of the dispute is at the moment.
And what is your assessment of the USMCA, Jennifer?
Well, again, I look at it to say, compared to what? To me, compared to what we would have had if we had simply stayed in the NAFTA and then added and stayed in the TPP, which has
the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
which has a lot of the provisions that are now in this new USMCA, were lifted divested entirely from the TPP and put into this new USMCA. That combination, to me, might have left us in a better place than this new USMCA agreement does. But nonetheless, is this new USMCA agreement better than leaving us at the current NAFTA? Yes, I think it is. And part of it is, it does have, I think, some new provisions, even with respect to autos, with respect to this adding in this concept that a certain portion of the amount of an auto has to be produced in a factory that has a $16 an hour minimum wage, I think is bringing in a new provision. It is pulling the labor and the environment provisions directly into the agreement so that if you get the enforcement provisions right, and I do say if, then there is a much more real mechanism by which you can make sure that the labor and the environment standards across the United States, Mexico, and Canada are actually adhered to.
I just want to be clear here. Is there anyone arguing we should just leave NAFTA entirely and go back to what existed pre-1992?
I think it's very hard to do that at this stage because you can't turn the clock back. And I think there are a lot of business relationships that have developed over time. So that's hard to imagine that that would be a useful way of going. But I think there are people who would argue we could do better, that if we wanted to renegotiate NAFTA.
Well, my sense is that's what the Democrats in the House are trying to do.
Exactly.
They've been going through this sort of informal additional renegotiation process.
So it's more forward-looking in terms of this isn't as good as it should be. There are, I think, some very problematic provisions with respect to pharmaceutical products that this agreement will actually raise prices of some pharmaceutical products and boost the profits of some of the wealthiest companies in the world. So that, I think,
that was
another.
A big sticking point in negotiations because my sense was the Mexicans and the Canadians weren't big fans of those provisions. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely fair to say, which means, you know, if the Democrats really push, I think one of the easy fixes would be to lower that time frame under which biologics.
This is about biologics. I'm not sure what a biologic is, even though I've tried reading about it several times. But the notion was how long this particular type
it's
of
how long you get
would be protected.
You get effective protection, meaning how long are you protected from any competition? And again, the longer you protect any molecule, pharmaceutical, anything from protection, the longer it is before generics or others can come in and push down the prices. So, I mean, Thea is absolutely right. The longer that time period is, the more expensive pharmaceuticals are. And would Canada and Mexico agree to lower the number? Absolutely yes. So that is one of the things that could come out of these negotiations.
But my sense is for a few senators in particular, this was like a red line. They had to get their, what was it, 11 years of protection?
There are always people in Congress who are more interested in the profits of the pharmaceutical companies than in lower prices for consumers.
Okay. We mentioned TPP. I want to talk a little bit about TPP. President Trump notably announced 3 days into his presidency that he had no interest in pursuing TPP. There is the irony that a lot of the chapters in the Trans-Pacific Partnership did end up in the USMCA. I'll put that aside. But I guess the question is, as we look at the TPP, is it something that should be revived? And I ask it in the context of the fact that I think a lot of people thought back in January 2017 when the United States walked away that the TPP would just collapse and that would be the end of it. But what happened was the other 11 negotiating partners put together something called the CPTPP, the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. And one of the interesting things about that was that that then put a number of American exporters, whether manufacturers or farmers, on the defensive because all of a sudden their goods became less competitive in that particular market. So how do you think about those trade-offs, Thea?
Well, it wasn't just Trump who didn't like the TPP. In fact, you know, the entire Democratic field and most of the Republican field and a lot of members of Congress also did not like the TPP. So in my view, this was a missed opportunity by the Obama administration, USTR negotiators, that it, you know, we did an agreement with 12 countries, many of whom we already had free trade agreements with. And so it was an opportunity, I think, to really do a new generation trade deal that would have put some of the labor and environmental and consumer concerns front and center. And instead, it was a little bit of an old school deal that, in my view, if it was our pivot to Asia, did not address some of the key concerns that the United States has, both in competitive terms and in foreign policy terms with the Asian countries around currency negotiation and around worker rights in particular. So I think that that agreement was a failed agreement and was negotiated on the wrong basis. And it's too bad that, you know, that that opportunity went by. But I don't think it's possible or desirable at this point to revive that old deal.
So what is your sense? I assume you can't go right back to TPP. My sense is the members of the CPTPP walked away from a number of the things the United States insisted on because they didn't like particularly this issue about biologics and how they're protected. So how do you think about this issue, Jennifer?
Well, I actually think the CPTPP is actually a better agreement than the TPP because of the things that were stripped out of it. So my own view is it is still, I mean, the CPTPP is closer to an agreement that the United States should want. And I always thought that there was a possibility that it could have been improved as it went through the process. And I would certainly not disagree with Thea on some of the things that would have improved it. I still think there would be a possibility, particularly the provisions, for example, on investor-state dispute settlement. Again, I'm not disagreeing that those could have been stripped out.
Could you briefly explain investor-state dispute settlement?
So investor-state dispute settlement is a provision that allows a private investor who has made an investment in a foreign country to claim that that foreign country has done something that has effectively taken away that property right. Either they've literally expropriated the property, or more often, they've passed a regulation. Say you've invested in a mine, and now the country in which the mine is located passes environmental regulations that you think makes it effectively impossible for you to ever operate your mine. So you now have the right as a private investor to seek a dispute settlement provision where the government of the country is in the docket to say, you've taken away my property right, you have to pay me X amount.
And this is rather than going through local courts.
Exactly. And that's the point. It is privileging a foreign investor and giving them a right that the same domestic investor would not have. If it were a domestic investor...
I can see why that would irritate me.
If it was a domestic investor in the mine, they would have gone to the domestic courts. And so, you know, the issue is whether or not those provisions should have been in the TPP. And the argument is always it depends on the quality of the courts in each one of those countries, whether you think they are up to the task of rendering a fair judgment. I don't think there was a particularly good argument for many of the countries that were in the TPP. I don't think we really have any reason to question the validity of the courts in Japan or Australia or New Zealand or many of the other TPP countries, Canada, etc. So I think that provision could have easily been taken out, and that would have been taken out gladly, I think, by most of the other members of the TPP.
And by most of the U.S. critics. Many of the U.S. critics would have welcomed that and have been arguing that this provision, these private investor rights are bad governance. They're anti-democratic, and they can often have been used to undermine legitimate environmental regulations. And so that's why they're very controversial and should never have been there.
I want to come back to a little bit of a process question, which is the use of tariffs. Obviously, with the Trump administration, we've seen a resurgence in the use of tariffs as a lever against trading partners. We've also seen the invocation, in I think fairly unusual ways, of provisions of U.S. trade law, most notably Section 232, which is a provision, I guess it goes back to a trade act of 1962 that allows the United States to impose tariffs for national security reasons. And I'm just curious, Thea, from your vantage point, has this been an effective tool of U.S. trade policy?
Tariffs can be an effective tool, and they're a necessary tool of trade policy. In some ways, what a tariff is a cross-border enforcement mechanism. So if you have a trade agreement with a country and you feel that that country is violating the terms of the agreement or unfairly subsidizing exports or blocking your exports, then you can use tariffs in a surgical and consistent and transparent way. The current administration's tariff policy, I think, has been erratic and inconsistent and badly messaged and done in such a way that it's just more confusing. It's confusing to businesses, it's confusing to government, and it has not been effective. But in the abstract, tariffs are a perfectly legitimate tool and a necessary tool of trade policy.
Jennifer?
I think to some degree it really depends on what's the point of the tariffs. And I think part of the reason why this has been so confusing and chaotic is it's really hard to tell. There are times when you listen to President Trump say, I'm a tariff man, you get the impression that he thinks that the tariffs are actually the goal, that the whole point of this is to build a tariff wall around the United States. And so that if you have a big, high tariff wall around the United States, then anybody that wants to sell something in the United States has to make it in the United States. I think there's huge problems if that's what you really think. I mean, first
why
of all,
are there huge problems?
First of all, you have to think about who pays these tariffs. The president may say, I'm going to just tax China, but the reality is it is Americans that pay the tariff. And that is a huge tax on Americans. I mean, the Trump tariffs so far, you know, are costing the average American family over $4,000 to pay these taxes that are put on imports. So part of it is, again, that we have to remember who pays the tariffs. But the other part of it has to be, what's the goal of the tariffs? I would agree with Thea that they can be, when properly used, an important source of leverage. But if we think about what's happened, for example, in the 232, the steel and the aluminum tariffs, none of our allies actually believed that these were legitimate. I mean, to say to Canada or to the European Union or Japan, you threaten the national security of the United States. These are our strongest allies. And we tell them you're threatening our national security. Their response was to put tariffs back on U.S. goods. So instead of helping those countries change their practice, which was never the goal of those tariffs, it was never the goal to change the practice of the European Union in terms of steel trade. Their response is to retaliate. And so now we have tariffs against the United States, and again, heavily against farm products coming out of the United States. So,
and Harley-Davidson motorcycles.
Well, so we are significantly hurting the U.S. farmers and the U.S. exporters of Harley-Davidson and whiskey and other things that are now the subject of these retaliatory tariffs that were put on because these countries did not believe that the United States was engaging in legitimate use of tariffs. Their perception was that these were wholly a violation of our WTO obligations and were wholly illegitimate. And so countries responded very quickly to what they perceived to be an unfair, illegitimate attack on their economies. And so we've ended up in this tit for tat. And again, it is Americans that are paying the price of it.
Well, sometimes, I mean, in terms of who pays the price, it actually is a little bit more complicated because it depends on the price elasticity of demand and it depends on the market.
Those are all economic terms we're not going to define here.
Yeah, but sometimes a company, for example, can choose to swallow the tariff for a period of time and not pass it along to consumers. So it's a little bit more complicated than who actually pays in any one instance. The other thing I think that's important to note is, you know, what are the legitimate uses of tariffs? And another one might be to safeguard an industry temporarily for a short period of time. And, you know, the United States, most countries in the WTO, there are provisions in the WTO for that legitimate use, that an industry is losing a lot of jobs really quickly, and we have a safeguard tariff that we are allowed to use for a limited period of time to let that industry get back on its feet. So it's important to remember that there are times in which we've all agreed that we should be able to use tariffs. And the other point I would just make in this context is that certainly the labor movement might think that the, you know, the terms of the WTO are too narrow in terms of when a tariff is legitimate. So the example I used before about whether there's egregious abuse of workers' rights. We do have the ability to use unilateral trade preference programs to temporarily impose tariffs to protest the violation of workers' rights that is undermining the trade relationship or the prices.
One last topic, and I probably erred in leaving this to the end because it may be the biggest of all, has to do with U.S. trade policy toward China. I have to ask, and maybe I'll begin with you, Thea, as you look at this, again, given your service on the U.S.-China Review Commission, how do you think about the current trade war? Is it something that is likely to produce a net benefit for the United States? What is it that we should want from China in terms of trade policy?
It's a complicated question, Jim, but thanks for asking. The U.S.-China trade relationship has been very frustrating for many decades, and it's been very imbalanced. We have about a $375 billion trade deficit with China, which I know people don't want to focus too much on bilateral trade deficits, but in the U.S.-China instance, that enormous, egregious trade imbalance is a sign that there are a lot of unfair trade practices on the part of China. So one thing we've learned through the current trade war is that in this sense, some of these hard-hitting mechanisms work in terms of getting the attention of the Chinese government and focusing. But as I said before, the Trump administration's tariff policy has been so erratic and so confusing and so stop and start, where it seems to be domestically, politically motivated by what's going on at home and if we need a distraction from something else. And that's not a way to use tariff policy.
If you could devise the policy, what would you want it to achieve? What do you want the Chinese to do that they're not currently doing?
Two things. I think, and that's another reason why the current tariff policy is not ideally crafted. I do think we need to deal with the currency misalignment between the United States and China. And this is something where if we put all of our trade policy on tariffs and subsidies, and yet another country has ways of manipulating or using currency, then we are kind of missing the boat. And I would say that is a big chunk of the U.S. problem with China. There's legislation been introduced, the Hawley-Baldwin legislation that would start to address currency issues. And the other issue is workers' rights. And when I worked at the AFL-CIO, we filed two Section 301 unfair trade practice cases against China on both workers' rights and currency. To me, those are the two areas that the U.S. government ought to be focusing on.
Do you think that China is currently manipulating its currency to get an advantage?
I think the U.S.-China currency is misaligned, which is different from whether there's active manipulation right now. But, you know, because of the
Can you explain to me what that means then, what it means to be misaligned?
That the U.S. dollar is overvalued relative to the Chinese currency because the Chinese government holds a lot of reserves of U.S. currency. They're not actively intervening today, but there is a misalignment between the values, which means that U.S. goods are too expensive, Chinese goods are too cheap.
So you would prefer to have a weaker dollar.
Yes.
And then the variety of ways to get that. We won't do the whole economics 101 or 401 explanation of that. Jennifer, how do you think about this China trade war issue? And also sort of in the context, the president likes to talk a lot about reciprocity. He wants reciprocal relations, which sounds very appealing. Everybody, you know, two countries should play by the same rules. So how do you think about all of this?
Well, part of it is I'm concerned about how do we get to any kind of an agreement with China. So my basic argument all along has been I think it is going to be nigh on to impossible for the United States to get an agreement that will be actually helpful to the United States when we take this go-it-alone approach. I think we're seeing the limited value of the tariffs that we have right now. I mean, this phase one agreement that is being talked about between the United States and China was described at a Council on Foreign Relations event by former USTR Mike Frohman as a purchase and sale agreement, meaning it's not really a trade agreement that is going to address the underlying issues.
We're just going to get the Chinese to buy more Iowa soybeans.
They're just going to get the Chinese to buy more American goods, but it is not going to resolve any of the underlying
problems. It's not getting to the structural problems, Thea.
Exactly, exactly.
And, you know, I would not disagree with Thea's list, but I would add to it, you know, the third issue that we really have to deal with China is the degree of state-owned enterprises and subsidies and the degree to which the Chinese Communist Party runs the economy. And that is unfair competition for U.S. companies to be expected to compete full on with the entire government of China that is propping up lots of state-owned enterprises and is sending in lots of goods that have been subsidized and is creating massive overcapacity in China, in steel, in aluminum, in chemicals, in many other products that are being produced on the backs of huge Chinese subsidies. So those are big and important issues that will not be touched by this phase one agreement. And I don't think there's any way that the U.S. has enough leverage to get China to touch them at all. We need a big coalition with our allies who agree with the United States' substantive concerns about China, but they do not agree with the United States' unilateral tactics. And for them, the fear is if they were to try to join with the United States, they would then be, if you will, sold down the river. If the U.S. takes an agreement that says China just buy more of our stuff and we'll be satisfied, that is completely leaving them out in the cold from that. So my concern is we really do need a big and structural agreement with China, and we're not going to get it with a go-it-alone unilateral approach.
Totally agree with that. I just want to say I think that, you know, the unfair trade practices, and one of the reasons there's so much frustration now is that past administrations, both Democratic and Republican, failed to address this massively unfair trading practices, subsidies, state-owned enterprise of the Chinese government. And I also agree with you, Jennifer, that this kind of policy would be much more effective if done in concert with our allies.
I have a sense we've come full circle here. We ended up talking about the rules of competition. I think we talked about it at the opening. The trade is really fundamentally about setting the terms of competition. So on that note of being full circle and having some agreement, I'm going to close up this special election 2020 episode of the President's Inbox for this week. My guests again have been Jennifer Hillman, CFR's Senior Fellow for Trade and International Political Economy, and Thea Lee, President of the Economic Policy Institute. Jennifer and Thea, thank you very much for joining me for today's conversation.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks.
I have posted links to what Jennifer, Thea, and others have written about trade on my blog, The Water's Edge. You can find the blog at CFR.org. Again, that's The Water's Edge on CFR.org. If you are not already subscribing to the President's Inbox, I hope you would consider doing so. You can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Whichever podcast service you use, I also hope that you would consider leaving us a review, as well as your suggestions for what topics to cover and which guests to invite. Your feedback helps us improve the show. As always, opinions opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Anthony LeBarry was a recording engineer. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This episode of the President's Inbox is made possible in part by a grant from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.